Thank you for downloading the Start the Week podcast from BBC Radio 4. For more information, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. Hello, this new year brings us two important and connected anniversaries. It's 100 years since women first got the vote, though by no means all women. Jane Robinson has written a gripping new history of the suffragists, not the picture-slashing, brick-throwing suffragettes, but their much more numerous, law-abiding and arguably more effective sisters who launched the epic Women's March on London in 1913. And we're going to be talking about another pioneering woman, Mary Shelley, on the 200th anniversary of the first publication of Frankenstein. Fiona Sampson's written a new biography, and I promise you will never think the same about Percy Bysshe Shelley ever again. Helping us circumnavigate the politics of women and monsters are the political theorist Christopher Finlay, whose specialism is the use of violence in political protest and when, if ever, it can be justified, and the artist Peter Kennard, whose famous photomontages became part of the essential iconography of CND. Jane Robinson, let's start with you. It's 1913, and something huge and unprecedented is happening in the country, something that has been forgotten by most historians.
That's right. This was what was called the Great Suffrage Pilgrimage. I think it's at the root of our tradition in this country of massed peaceful protest. It was essentially a march. It took place over 6 weeks in the summer of 1913. It was organised by the suffragists, who were the non-violent campaigners for the vote. It involved thousands of women from all backgrounds, all generations, some men as well. They set off from points around the UK to converge in a massed rally in Hyde Park in London in July. This meant 6 weeks on the road for some of them.
And you had washerwomen and duchesses marching together in sharing caravans. It was a big social mix as well, wasn't it?
It's like some great sort of post-Edwardian road movie, really. People from all different backgrounds marching together, making friends as they went, discovering themselves and each other, but mostly trying to persuade the country that votes for women was not only a good idea, but not a dangerous one, because everybody at the time was obsessed, gripped by the violence of the suffragettes.
We'd had Emily Wilding Davidson throwing herself under the King's horse. We'd had the picture slashing in the National Gallery. We'd had brick throwing. We'd had arson. And these were the women saying, we're not all like this. We can be trusted with the vote, you men.
Exactly. The whole point was to show that women were responsible enough and committed enough to use the vote with good sense and credibility when it came. And all this was happening at a time when the newspapers were absolutely fizzing with things like Emily Wilding Davison and the slashing of portraits.
And when we say it was one pilgrimage or one march, it was actually a whole series of marches from different parts of the country. There was the sort of Kent route and the East Coast route and the Scottish route and so forth.
That's right. You had caravans, horses, cyclists meandering through the West Country from Carlisle and Newcastle in the north, from Kent, as you say. And I would love to have seen these strings of women just step by step
tramping down the country
but tramping towards political freedom.
Absolutely. One of the very interesting things about your book is the very different responses they got in different places, because in some places they had huge public meetings, an enormous amount of support, men and women clapping and applauding them and going to their meetings and being won over, and in other places they had horrible violence inflicted on them.
Yeah, because a lot of the people who came to their meetings along the way couldn't read. It didn't matter if they had a banner saying non-militant, because they couldn't read it.
Yeah.
Or they didn't know what non meant. And so they assumed that these were suffragettes, that they were terrorists. And so they were indeed pelted with a very unlovely artillery of dead rats and cowpats and rocks. They were assaulted. The clothes were torn from their body. They were kicked. They were hit. Part of the problem was that the anti-suffragists always tried to get to a destination a day or two before the suffragists got
there. Whip everybody up.
To whip everybody up. And my goodness, it worked.
Let's talk a little bit about the ultimate leader of this movement, Millicent Fawcett, because she's less well known, of course, than the Pankhursts, but an extraordinary woman in her own right. Just tell us a little bit about her.
An extraordinary woman from an extraordinary family, actually. Her sister was Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, who was the first doctor to qualify in this country. Millicent never went to university herself. She didn't have the opportunity, but she was a highly self-educated woman. She would have been a fantastically astute politician. She put herself at the head of the constitutionalists who were campaigning for the vote, and as such had to navigate her way through not only what the suffragettes were doing, but what the politicians were trying to promise, broken promises. It was a very difficult job for her to navigate her way through this campaign.
And she and her allies created a very complex and sophisticated national organisation. So they learned an awful lot about administration, how to run things. And then during the First World War, just tell us what happens to them.
Well, there was a sort of truce during the First World War when both the militants and the non-militants decided that they were not going to campaign overtly for the vote. And what most of the suffragists did, Mrs. Fawcett's group, was to join a movement called the Scottish Women's Hospitals. It wasn't necessarily that you had to be Scottish. And they worked as orderlies, as doctors, as nurses, as surgeons, doing whatever they could. Meanwhile, always sort of ratcheting up the responsibility that they were taking, so that by the time the war ended, the vote, I think, was not given so much as a reward for what they've done, but as a recognition that they had trained before the vote.
Embedded themselves in the fabric of the country at an administrative and organisational level, so they could not be ignored by 1918. They were simply part of the public sphere.
Exactly. And it was what they had done during the Great Pilgrimage and during the suffragist campaign that had fit them for the work they did during the war, which in turn fit them for the vote.
Now, Jane, there's a great argument, of course, about who were the more effective, because, of course, all the headline grabbers were the suffragettes and the highly undemocratic Pankhurst outfit. And your people, as it were, your people, the people you've written about, more numerous, won more people over. But, of course, there is an argument that without the brick throwing and without the picture slashing and so forth, they wouldn't have really been able to do what they could do.
And that's something that Millicent Fawcett highlighted herself. They needed, it's very tempting to say that we needed, but they needed the publicity that the suffragettes brought in to bring the whole argument to public attention. But you couldn't rely on the suffragettes because they were increasingly being seen as terrorists. You had to have this undercurrent of good sense and responsibility. So the two had to work to a certain extent together.
And quite a lot of the suffragists were in fact conservatives.
They were indeed, and some of the suffragists were also members of Mrs. Pankhurst's outfit, as you put it. So it's very difficult to box these campaigners up.
And in terms of the rivalry between the two parts of the movement, as it were, a lot of rivalry, but a lot of fellow feeling as well. So when a suffragette was removed from prison, having been subjected to forced feeding and hunger strike, the suffragists were very often on her side.
They were indeed. And during the Great Pilgrimage, when some of the suffragists were attacked, it was often suffragettes who came to their aid, took them to their houses to shelter them.
Can I ask then about whether this is I'll turn to Christopher Finlay now, because you're a theorist of these things. The extent to which the kind of division between suffragettes and suffragists is part of everybody's political history, wherever you are in the world. Conflict between, do you go for the more violent approach or do you have the constitutional change makers marching alongside? How do you get that balance working?
I think, the first thing to say about it really is it depends on context, and not only for the balance, but really for how these terms are interpreted. I mean, one of the key issues, I think, at various points, it's an issue now for protesters, anti-globalisation protesters, anti-fascist protesters and so on. It was a big issue in the 1960s, the late 1960s, and it was an issue, I think, for the suffragists and suffragettes, is to contest the line between militant and non-militant, between violent and non-violent, legal and illegal, and between the demonstration and the protest, which is another dichotomy that I think the suffragists played on. And that line is, I think, reinterpreted in different contexts. So
if you're asked with, you're confronted in the meeting by Millicent Fawcett and lots of very serious, very responsible, respectable women, but you know the kind of at their back, as it were, is another kind of force.
Well, the great thing about Asquith was that it was only after the Great Pilgrimage and the suffragists made a deputation there that he actually admitted for the first time that perhaps women could be considered as people in a political sense. And up until then, he hadn't been prepared to admit that. And therefore, they could be included in a representation of the People Act, which gave them the vote.
Why do you think that the suffragists have suffered in terms of history of not being known about? I mean, is it because in a sense they might be more dangerous because it was women from all classes, from it was a mass movement?
There is that, but I think on a very simple level, it's because the whole point of the suffragette campaign of violence was to grab attention and was to be sensationalist and was to obsess people and shock people, and it worked.
But the other thing that I was really struck by in this book, talking about, as it were, the visual artistic side of this, is we know that the WSPU had their colours of green, white and purple and all of that, but actually the suffragists had a completely different set of iconography and colours and so forth.
They did. Their colours were red and green and white. It's difficult when you're looking at photographs of this period, of course, which are all black and white, to recognise whether the sashes they are wearing are in the suffragette or the suffragist colours.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But indeed they did, and if they could afford it, the pilgrims on the Great Pilgrimage were encouraged to wear a particular sort of uniform for walking in. They got through pairs and pairs and pairs of walking boots, of course, swarming with blisters. And it said, just as an interesting little aside, that because Mrs. Fawcett said that they should wear skirts that were 4 inches shorter than usual so that they didn't get all caught up in the mud on this 6-week march, that made the fashion after the pilgrimage of shorter skirts for ladies.
Oh, very interesting. We're going to talk with Peter a little bit later about art and protest and so forth, but actually the art of the suffragists is quite important too. It's the arts and crafts movement, beautifully embroidered and created banners and images as well.
Yeah, the legacy of art that we have connected with both the suffragist and the suffragette campaigns is so rich, absolutely beautiful. And of course it was very important for the point I made before that many, many people couldn't read, so they needed the image to arrest their attention.
And Christopher Finlay, sorry.
Just, I was interested, Jane, to know, do you think, you've said that there was some degree of synergy between the two sides. Do you think the suffragette movement was justified, morally speaking, the sort of militant action that they resorted to? Did they cross the line, or was this in fact a sort of justifiable campaign of militancy and violence and so on?
It's a very difficult question, but I would say that if you look at the suffragette campaign side by side with the suffragist campaign, it was justified, but because it gave the impetus to the suffragist campaign, which I think was the one that finally changed Parliament's mind. But the two had to have the sweet and the sour, if you like, to work.
The two wings. Fiona Sampson.
One of the things I really loved about your book, Jane, was the way you didn't exactly mirror this two-string approach, but you have this wonderful, quite intimate storytelling, and then you have these fabulously comprehensive glossaries, the names of the movements and so on, all mapped out. And there are the sort of the two approaches, the personal and the formal, as it were, headline approach. And that seems to me to echo something going on in the suffragist-suffragette.
Yeah, and I think the great thing about the pilgrimage was that it was an intensely personal experience for a lot of the women that were on it, and I worked from diaries and letters and things. And what moved me, I think, most was that everybody involved in it, and there were thousands, felt that what they were doing counted. Right from the one busy housewife and mother who didn't have the time or the money to go on the pilgrimage herself, but thought, I want to contribute to this, what can I do? And she gathered scraps of the family's food from the table for a week, packed them into a little package, and when the pilgrimage passed by, walked to meet them, presented them with this little packed lunch to help them on their way. And that was her contribution to the fight for the vote. Mm-hmm. And it's because of what she did that I have a vote.
Mm. Absolutely extraordinary. We're going to suddenly go back another 100 years to another extraordinary woman here, Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. It was published exactly 200 years ago.
Yes.
Mary, we've been talking about the rights of women, so let's talk about the vindication of the rights of women. Mary Shelley's mother's great work. Just tell us a little bit about her family background first.
Mary was born the daughter of two radicals. Her father was William Godwin, who was a radical philosopher. 4 years before she was born, he'd written Political Justice and Caleb Williams, which were both anti-hierarchical. They were actually quite revolutionary calls to arms. One's philosophy, one's a novel. Her mother, who died as a result of giving birth to her, was Mary Wollstonecraft, who famously wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, and that's what Godwin put on her tombstone. So it shows what the domestic concerns were, which was a supplement to A Vindication of the Rights of Men, which she'd written 2 years earlier in response to Burke and the French Revolution. So in other words, women's rights sitting inside human rights already.
So a big sort of intellectual heritage on this young girl's shoulder. And where does she first learn to shape her letters?
She learns to shape her letters by tracing her own name on her mother's tombstone. Yeah. So, and of course, she grows up surrounded by her father's library. Of course, she doesn't get to go to school. She doesn't get to go to university, but she has her father's library. She gets 6 months in a improving school for ladies in Ramsgate, and which I suspect probably put her back rather than set her forwards intellectually. And she was also surrounded by a whole, more than a coterie, really a kind of generation of intellectuals who came through the house. Intellectuals, but also artists. William Blake was a family friend. Coleridge was a family friend. Sarah Siddons was her father's friend. So Sir Humphrey Davy. I mean, an extraordinary variety of
they're
people.
North London intellectuals. Well, they're not North London.
Plus ça change.
Yeah, indeed.
But maybe gave her a sense of intellectual entitlement, which was extraordinarily unusual, obviously, for a young girl.
And what is, again, extraordinary to me is how old she was when she wrote Frankenstein. She was still a teenager.
Yes, exactly.
Very, very young.
Extraordinary. I mean, everything she did, of course, was precocious. I mean, she ran away with Shelley when she was 16. By the time she was correcting the proofs of Frankenstein at the end of 1817, and Frankenstein, by the way, was her second book. She published a travel book before that. She was. She gave birth for the third time. She'd already lost her first child. She got married, she'd experienced suicide, she'd travelled to Europe and back again at a time when it was neither easy nor safe. I mean, extraordinary, but I suppose when you're 18 and 19, you don't realise it's extraordinary. But we do, of course, looking back.
And into her life comes one of the most disgraceful, disreputable people I've ever come across on the page. I had no idea quite how awful Percy Bysshe Shelley was. Almost everybody, certainly every woman who comes into contact with him, either dies or kills themselves or is totally destroyed.
And certainly has a baby.
Certainly has a baby, absolutely.
Yes.
So he's this young, self-obsessed, sort of, he's the ultimate kind of self-absorbed, vain revolutionary.
A vain revolutionary poet, we have to say, I'm afraid. And the great irony for me is that I came to Mary Shelley through working on Percy. Right. I prepared an edition of his poems. And while I was doing that, I was trying to make sense of the disparate elements of his personality. You know, he obviously liked the ladies. He apparently was a revolutionary, a social revolutionary. He was part of a communitarian community and so on. But he obviously loved the set freedom and revolution in a quite a personal, emotional way, rather than having any sense of political responsibility.
He seems to me have no sense of other people's reality at all. So he travels and he drags women in particular after him. He has no interest in whether they are capable of the journeys, whether they're in childbirth, whether they're pregnant, whether they're depressed. It doesn't matter to him. The only thing that matters to him is Percy Bysshe Shelley.
Absolutely. And also, it doesn't matter to him that he's going through, for example, when they elope in 1814, they pass through a France which is absolutely ravaged by revolution and war. And they even note this in the journal, which both of them keep sometimes. Typically, Percy won't even let Mary keep her own journal for some of the time. And they say things like, oh, well, you know, we know they've just been through a war and they're starving, but they were so ungracious to us that we can't feel pity. I mean, extraordinary solecism.
Absolutely.
And when they go to Villa Diodati for the famous set piece where they have this writing competition led by Lord Byron, which produces...
It's who's going to write the best ghost story, essentially.
And again, they're going through a Europe where thousands are starving because it's a year without a summer because of the eruption of Mount Tambora in what's now Indonesia. And so there's literally no summer. There's no spring or autumn either. I mean, there's ice in the lakes. People are starving all over Europe. Happily, they pass through this, not mentioned once. Mm.
It is remarkable. And Shelley, of course, leaves his first wife, who's pregnant, for Mary Shelley, Mary Wollstonecraft, Mary Godwin. And what happens to the first wife? Because, I mean, I'm piling Pelion on Otter here a little bit.
Yes. Well, the first wife kills herself when she finds she's pregnant for the third time. Now, Percy...
By jumping into the Serpentine.
By jumping into the Serpentine, which seems to me...
How does that work?
Well, it was December, so she might have frozen, but it does seem to me like a kind of public call for help. But on the other hand... Maybe it wasn't, because in those days, if you survived, you would be institutionalised as insane. So that wouldn't have solved her life. It's not, she wouldn't have got therapy and been brought back into the bosom of her family. And the question too is, was she pregnant by Percy that third time? It's not impossible.
Not impossible, but he responds by trying to trash her reputation.
Yes, and claims that there was someone called Smith.
Mm.
which I suspect is the first use of Smith as a kind of euphemism for sexual encounter.
Yes. Ugandan encounters. Meanwhile, Mary's half-sister has also killed herself.
Yes, Mary's half-sister has also killed herself. Mary's half-sister has killed herself because she realises that she will never have a life. She won't be able to marry because she has been rendered, the whole family has been rendered unrespectable by Mary running away. Eloping. She's also discovered she won't get a job as a teacher. She's been turned down by that.
And then there's Mad, Bad and Dangerous to Know Lord Byron in the middle of this as well.
Yes, but I have to say that Lord Byron comes out of it quite well. For example, he retains literary respect for Mary throughout. Mm. He doesn't make a move on her. He continues to work with her. I mean, OK, it's her fair copying his work, but even after Percy's death, he's one of the few who doesn't abandon her. I think something that's very interesting too, just coming back to the half-sister, is that the report in the Cambrian, what's now the Cambrian News, of course doesn't name her because she died, you know, she's buried anonymously, but it reports her as of dark complexion. And that's really interesting because her father, Gilbert Imlay, was North American, and we don't know much about him, but the one portrait of him, he does indeed have a dark sort of Mediterranean colouring complexion. And that's very interesting because if that were the case, that's another very radical thing that Mary Wollstonecraft did while she was in France with Gilbert Imlay.
It is possible to see Mary Shelley's story as a kind of tragic unravelling of some of the theories of her mother in the context of a very, very repressive era.
Yes, it is. I think it's also very interesting to read Frankenstein in terms of Mary's life. I mean, both retroactively and prospectively. I think Frankenstein is terribly interesting about, it sits right in the middle of the romantic struggle with what the self is. You know, there's Frankenstein's creature made of lots of different people's bits. There's Frankenstein's creature. He's a tabula rasa. He is born benevolent but is made malevolent by being rejected. And he's treated as a morally responsible agent, i.e. as a subject, i.e. as that's what personhood is.
And we should say, for those who don't know, that in the original edition of the book, there's no galvanic electricity, or there's
absolutely
no moment.
It's
a very, very different kind of process of creating Frankenstein. Christopher Finlay.
On that question, so Mary's parents are both Enlightenment intellectuals. Mm. I just wonder to what extent Frankenstein's monster and the creation of the monster maybe even marks a rebellion against that. I mean, this is a scientist who creates a new person, but who then can't quite follow through in creating the people or the race or the society. Mm. And, you know, her parents, particularly Godwin, is committed to the idea that reason and science can lead to the creation of a new society and its reshaping. Is there a rejection of that in Frankenstein?
No, I think there's an exploration. I think what's really interesting about Mary is she's writing just at the start of modernity. So that anxiety, that kind of push me, pull you between hope and fear, between progress is good and overreaching is bad, is going on. And I think at the same time, she's early enough that she sits at the moment where the two disciplines, you know, C.P. Snow's two cultures, have not yet separated, and science and philosophy are still the same thing. They're still natural philosophy. So she hasn't. So ethics, for example, and ontology and so on, haven't been separated out from observation. And so she's really beautifully placed. She sits right on that cusp. And I think the Gothic is so much fancy dress, really. That was the occasion. That's what got her going. But, and it's also actually what sold the book, because it was sold as a genre novel to a publisher of genre novels. But I think its abiding interest is precisely that she speaks to she speaks to the misfit between personhood and technological intellectual progress. That is, you know, it is a sort of sore, the rubbing sore at the heart of modernity.
And I suppose, Jane Robinson, the other thing is that coming from the Mary Wollstonecraft Vindication of the Rights of Women tradition, she is in many respects a radical figure, but what she doesn't have is a society that has radicals around her. She has no sisterhood around her, really. And that's the difference.
That indeed is a difference, and it's only when step by step, bit by bit, this sisterhood begins to build up that real progress is made.
Mm.
Well, let's move on to some of the theories behind what we've been talking about. Christopher Finlay is Professor of Political Theory at Durham University, and you have looked most of your professional life at the difference between legitimate and illegitimate violence and different forms of protest. Can I ask you first of all about the importance of Frantz Fanon? Because for an entire generation of radicals in modern times, Fanon was on the bookshelf.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a number of different approaches to the question of violence in the context of protest or in the context of resistance or revolution. In the background, I think there's a widespread assumption that violence might have to occur in revolution because power is based on the ability to coerce, and the ability to coerce is on the availability of violence. So if you want to defeat an oppressive state, you may need an army, you may need a guerrilla war or something of that sort. This idea is challenged at different times, but in the 1960s particularly, figures like Hannah Arendt, Gene Sharpe, question this by saying, you know, really this misunderstands the nature of political power, and it misunderstands what you're trying to resist, because power isn't really based on one man with a gun.
And Hannah Arendt thinking in the context of Czechoslovakia, yes, the Hungarian uprising and so on.
Exactly. Immediately after 1968, there's this flurry of activity amongst philosophers. Articles, debates, the New York Review of Books has a debate with Arendt and Conor Cruz O'Brien and others. And so what she argues is power is based on opinion, it's based on will, it's based on acquiescence. Sharp argues the same thing. So if you want to defeat an autocratic government, you have to defeat it on the plane of public opinion, public
you have
will.
Your pilgrimage to,
yeah,
to London in 1913, as it were.
Yeah. So it's about changing consciousness, raising consciousness, transforming people's interactions with each other. And really violence, Arendt thinks, is a horribly inappropriate means to introduce into those relationships. It entirely corrupts politics.
And she is responding to Fanon, who comes out of the colonial liberation struggles, very different background.
Exactly. So there's this third possibility, which really takes it a step further, and she wants to challenge that. So Georges Sorel in the first decade of the 20th century, Frantz Fanon writing particularly in one essay in particular in 1961, in his last work, In the Wretched of the Earth, who argues, yes, it is about consciousness. Yes, it is about the psychology of the oppressed as an individual and as a people and their interaction. But the means of changing that consciousness is violence. Violence is a way of forcing people out of acquiescing in
particularly
oppression.
Because you can persuade the state to respond with more violence, and therefore you create a sort of victimhood, which then becomes more attractive and brings in the middle, as it were.
Yeah. So in that way of thinking about violence, it's not really tactical. This is what Sorel said. It's not about force meeting force. It's not Clausewitzian wrestlers or duelists. It's about action and reaction, and it's about the drama that then plays out and changes the way people think.
Which is surely exactly what the suffragettes were about, because by going on hunger strike and obliging the state to aggressively force feed them the horror of that, they then mobilise lots of people who wouldn't otherwise be brought in.
Indeed, and it's actually, ironically perhaps, it's a common theme between these Fanon, who's sometimes associated with a kind of terrorist radicalisation, and civil rights movements in the United States in the 1960s, and I suspect the suffragettes too, whether or not they were using violence, there's an intention to get the other side to use violence, because if the state force-feeds prisoners or sends attack dogs and water hoses out against peaceful protesters, or, you know, uses napalm against the Algerian people, it delegitimizes the state, it shows desperation and a loss of control, and it radicalizes and enrages the oppressed population, and then mobilizes them, perhaps, towards the Great Pilgrimage or a popular non-violent movement of that sort.
Jane Robinson.
It's interesting, though, because if you're using violence to provoke violence, then there's a sort of implicit assumption that you are then going to be a victim. And what the suffragists so didn't want to be was a victim. They wanted to be on an equal standing politically. They didn't want to be seen as the victims.
Yeah, but I think you can be a victim in different ways. You can be a passive victim who allows things to happen, or you can be the victim who brings about the error, the critical tactical error that the other side makes. And I suspect there's a degree of both. I mean, nobody
wanted... like what the IRA did for a while, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the IRA, I think, were influenced to some degree by Fanon. Richard English tells the story of copies being available in the prisons amongst IRA prisoners. So, yeah, I mean, it's a common feature in the 20th century of radical movements, whether violent or non-violent, to try to... Gene Sharp talks about jiu-jitsu, trying to force the other side to throw themselves at you and then topple over and collapse.
The violence comes from, say, fascists walking through an area of, you know, a multicultural, like the Battle of Cable Street or whatever. So the violence erupts, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that the people who are opposing the fascists going through are violent. It's that the act of it is violent in itself, the act of fascists marching through a Jewish area.
Some of them are deliberately trying. I mean, you talk, bring this right up to date, the Antifa. Is it Antifa? How do you say it? Antifa movement.
I think so, yeah.
Anti-alt-right movement in America is having this very, very debate just now, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, if the first idea is tactical, the second idea is sort of peaceful, popular movements. Fanon, it's about a sort of catalytic approach to violence. Mm. It's an eclectic debate now. I think the argument from anarchists commonly is that you need to have a diversity of tactics. So you may have a degree of tactical violence in defence against fascist violence, I mean physical violence. There may also be symbolic attacks. There may be civil disobedience and a variety of other things going on together. And really, there shouldn't be an orthodoxy that says it should be non-violent or violent. Yeah. It should be
Fiona Sampson.
What's fascinating, it seems to me, in both your work, Chris and Jane, is that you made me realise that these debates are not about ethics; they're pragmatic debates. So the ground has really shifted. Are the headliners, as it were, or the persuaders going to be more effective? It's not anymore about the ethics of violence or peaceful protest. It's not Arendt. It's not Gandhi.
I'm going to jump in here as well, picking up on that, because you distinguish very much between violence against people and violence against things. For instance, Nelson Mandela was a great supporter of sabotage, but not violence against people.
Yeah, but although he doesn't exclude that possibility altogether to say it never could be justified, I think moral justification and ethics depend on practical efficacy. If you know it's not going to work, you can't really justify inflicting a harm. You can't justify guerrilla war, for example.
There are ethical debates around violence per se, aren't there?
Yeah, sorry. No, I mean, I'm partly qualifying rather than disagreeing, but effectiveness is part of the debate, but there will also be, I think, moral dimensions.
I just want to move the argument one stage further about persuading people through images, in particular in Peter Kennard's work. You've got an exhibition, Revolt and Revolution, at the Yorkshire Sculpture Park at the moment.
Yeah,
Peter.
It's a group exhibition.
But you are particularly well known for those CND or anti-nuclear related images you've used of a nuclear weapon being broken on a CND badge, of the cruise missiles being imposed on the constable's haywain, of the mushroom cloud that becomes a skeleton. Just tell us a little bit about the history, first of all, of photomontage, which is your particular art form.
Well, I mean, it began with the Dadaists, which was collage, people like the great collage artist Hannah Hock, who made very explosive work.
In the 30s.
In the 20s. Where the collage is like a shattered mirror looking at society after the First World War, the sort of chaos.
And then the great John Hartfield.
And then Hartfield came in to make much more specific images, where you join two images together to create a critique. So you show
Hitler satirizing Hitler.
And you show Hitler doing a salute, but you show the money coming in from the corporate, the capitalists, into his hand. So you show everyday gestures, but you show them being completely transformed by an anti-fascist ethos that he's.
This is the art mainly of the left. I mean, I also think a lot of the early Soviet art and so forth uses photomontage, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the right uses it as well. They try to use it, but they usually do it by just blowing up enlarging images of the dictators that they support, rather than trying to create a sort of dialectic in the work.
I guess part of the problem these days is that we're so familiar with images become desensitized very, very quickly.
Yeah.
So you're constantly trying to make people look again.
Yeah.
How do you
yeah.
do that? What's the process?
Well, I think that's been the basis of a lot of what. I mean, images of the nuclear explosion were normalized. It was one of the most popular posters in Athena poster shop. Was a giant mushroom cloud, all beautifully airbrushed, as an acceptable image. So my feeling was that if you ever have these images, you've got to break them. You've got to show the possibility of destroying them, like the one with the broken missile, that it shows a missile, but it shows it actually being broken by human action, by protest.
The suffragettes famously went into the National Gallery and attacked a few paintings.
Yeah.
You've never attacked a painting, but what you have done is you have fundamentally altered Constable's Haywain, that very, very famous, iconic, bucolic image.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to do that?
Well, it was when they were bringing crews, which is a euphemism in itself, we're going on a nice cruise. You know, it's equal to 18 Hiroshima as a cruise missile. Anyway, they were bringing cruise missiles into Greenham Common and to Molesworth. And the idea was that these missiles were going to radiate 50 miles around the the bases, and the government produced.
So they were in the heart of rural England.
Yeah, the heart of rural England. The government produced a leaflet which had a beautiful watercolour done by a Ministry of Defence watercolourist. I don't know if there was one, but there is one showing the missiles melting into the countryside. And one of the spokesmen said, they'll melt into the countryside. Don't worry about them. You know, not that we'll melt into the countryside, but. And so I got the idea of using a rural image, and the hay wain is obviously the most famous. You know, it's on the tea towels and it's on everything, and it's a great painting. So I just put the missiles onto the cart, and then produced I got a photograph of it from the National Gallery, and then produced postcards. And the best way is as a postcard, and I heard that people, especially, you know, American tourists, sent it back to Texas, yes. And they didn't realise the missiles were on the cart, you know, when they sent the image back. So it was nice to infiltrate work in that way.
And these images become, in many respects, we were talking right at the beginning about people who were not literate, not being clear what the banners were, but in many cases it's the image itself that has the bigger.
But that's what's so
impact.
Important about it in terms of getting people to actually think critically. Because I think of my work, it's not propaganda, it's actually getting people to think critically. And it's people that are not going to, you know, most people are not going to sit down and read political philosophy, but if they see an image that actually breaks the sort of hegemony of the sort of corporate imagery that we're bombarded with,
have to be
it makes them think.
Shocked.
It makes them think. And you've got to make it very direct, because everyone's only working in a small economic area. I haven't got giant billboards I can work with or whatever. So it's got to get through in 2 seconds.
So for people who are listening and may not be familiar with your work, for instance, the image of the Earth with a gas mask on would be another good example.
Yeah. Well, it's looking at an Earth, which is the most beautiful photo ever taken of the Earth from the space shot, and then putting a gas mask on, which actually fits onto it. It was done from a photograph. It stuck a gas mask on a globe. So it's got to have a reality about it. It's like a surrealist object. It's got to have a reality, but that reality will confound everyday imagery.
Fiona.
What I absolutely love about your images, which of course are very famous and definitely changed my politics, is the way the disruption, the moment of change is there simultaneously. And images, you know, words go through time. They're not simultaneous, whereas an image shows the disruption happening. I mean, like you're wearing the lapel brooch, there it is, with your broken cruise in the CND.
It's an instant image, and hopefully it gets people to think critically. I mean, people say to me, well, what do you expect it to do? You know, and you can't measure what it does. It's not like selling baked beans where you can measure, you know, when you advertise.
No, but the interesting thing is...
But it gets people to think, and to think about their own position in relation to it.
And the interesting thing is that some of your images are so iconic now that they are part of the register of how we think.
This is how we think. We think through pictures, first and foremost.
Yeah.
Maybe that was the problem. Maybe that's why the suffragists needed a new book to remind us about them, because they didn't have the image of Emily Wilding Davidson falling in front of the King's horse, or of Mrs. Pankhurst being grabbed by coppers outside Westminster, or people throwing bricks. They didn't have those images, and words will only take you so far.
And an image. And of course, we're bombarded by images that have no meaning other than to try and sell us stuff. So if you see something that's actually trying to break open meaning, hopefully it gets through to people.
And so you wonder sometimes whether the whole surrealist art movement has any modern validity. But in many ways, this is what you're about, isn't it? It is the political importance of surrealism.
Yeah, it is, because I'm creating something that has a reality about it. It's not like a collage of fragments.
Can I ask you about one sort of contemporary problem, which is Photoshop, to put it brutally?
Yeah.
It is so easy now to manipulate images, to change them, and you can't see the joins. You get these nice, glossy, changed, manipulated... You know, you can take any photograph and make it look like a Van Gogh, or you can impose and jam together different images very, very easily. Does that make photomontage more difficult to retain as a sort of shock value art?
Well, I think everything is more difficult in terms of imagery to retain a shock value, but I think Photoshop is terrific because it's opened it up to millions of people, and it's sort of made it even more as a sort of democratic art form.
And just describe the Tony Blair Photoshop that you were involved in, for instance.
That was a collaborative work with Cat Phillips, and that was Tony Blair in front of a oil explosion with a holding up a mobile phone.
Taking a selfie.
Taking a selfie, which originally was a group of young army cadets. And it was just to show the next stage of the sort of madness and the sort of...
Solipsism.
And the sort of blindness of Blair.
Christopher.
I was just wondering if you, going back to the suffragettes, as an artist you talk about ripping through lies, rupture, destruction and so on. Are you an ist or are you an et in this sort of protest art? Where do you see it? In that
We've all
spectrum?
Got ists or ets now.
Ists or ets, yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's a combination. I think, you know, you're breaking something up to actually show that it is possible to break it. I think that's the important thing. That's why, you know, I want people to make their own versions of the images and to see them as something, as a resource. You know, they're part of the protest movement. They're not something that's going to change things in themselves, but they're part of a protest to get away from the sort of madness that's going on in the world.
Jane Robinson.
I think you're the perfect combination, actually, because I think perhaps where the suffragettes didn't quite get it right was that they shocked without inviting debate. And it was deeds, not words. And I think the ets were deeds and words. And I think that's what your work is.
And I think that's what the power of art is. I mean, I don't know if Andrew's agree, but it's an expression of belief. It's an expression of something in the world.
But it's communication. It has to start some kind of dialogue or invite some kind of response in the mind of the person watching or listening.
Yeah.
If there isn't a kind of crackle, then it doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
Fiona,
I was going to come to the art thing, actually. I was going to say that sense of there's the headline moment and then there's this kind of deep ramification behind it.
We have to leave it there. I don't know whether it's something to do with the BBC on this day of all days, but you're all wearing purple, slightly suffragette badges on the BBC's internal purposes. Now, Christopher Finlay is Professor of Political Theory at Durham University. Jane Robinson's excellent book, Hearts and Minds, Suffragettes, Suffragists and How Women Won the Vote, and Fiona Sampson's excellent In Search of Mary Shelley are both published this month, and you can see works by Peter Kennard at the Revolt and Revolution exhibition at the Yorkshire Sculpture Park until April. Next week, Tom Sutcliffe will be here talking to the great Australian novelist Peter Carey, but for now, thank you and goodbye.
There's more information about Start the Week on the programme's website. Go to bbc.co.uk, where you'll also find many more Radio 4 programmes you can download for free.